Uthakalding looked beyond the fringe of their sunshade, where the bright afternoon had begun to color from an overcast spilling over the mountains. Out there in the bush, his confederate had been laying clues for weeks, ever since the Timbrimi yacht came down where Uthakalding had intended it to, at the edge of the marshlands, far southeast of the mountains. Little Jojo, the throwback Jim, who could not even speak except with his hands, moved just ahead of Uthakalding, naked as an animal, laying tantalizing footprints, chipping stone tools to leave in their path, maintaining tenuous contact with Uthakalding through the blue water globe. It had all been part of a convoluted plan to lead the Thenodin inexorably to the conclusion that pre-sentient life existed on Garth. But Kalt had seen none of the clues, none of the specially contrived hints. No, what Kalt had finally noticed was Jojo himself, the traces the little Chim left as he foraged and lived off the land. Uthakalding realized that Sealth Kuan was exactly right. The joke on himself was rich indeed. He thought he could almost hear Methakluana's voice once again.
"You never know,"
she seemed to say.
"Amazing," he told the Thenodin. "That is simply amazing."
Chapter 61 Athaclena. Every now and then, she worried that she was getting too used to the changes. The rearranged nerve endings, the redistributed fatty tissues, the funny protrusion of her now so humanoid nose. These were things now so accustomed that she sometimes wondered if she would ever be able to return to standard Timbrimi morphology. The thought frightened Athaclena. Until now, there had been good reasons for maintaining these humaniform alterations. While she was leading an army of half-uplifted wolfling clients, looking more like a human female had been more than good politics. It had been a sort of bond between her and the Chims and gorillas.
"And with Robert," she remembered.
Athaclena wondered, would the two of them ever again experiment, as they once had, with the half-forbidden sweetness of interspecies dalliance? Right now it seemed so very unlikely. Their consortship was reduced to a pair of signatures on a piece of tree bark, a useful bit of politics. Nothing else was the same as before. She looked down. In the murky water before her, Athaclena saw her own reflection.
"Neither fish nor fowl,"
she whispered in Anglic, not remembering where she had read or heard the phrase, but knowing its metaphorical meaning. Any young Timbrimi male who saw her in her present form would surely break down laughing. And as for Robert, well, less than a month ago she had felt very close to him. His growing attraction toward her, the raw, wolfling hunger of it, had flattered and pleased her in a daring sort of way.
"Now, though, he is among his own kind again, and I am alone."
Athaclena shook her head and resolved to drive out such thoughts. She picked up a flask and scattered her reflection by pouring a quarter liter of pale liquid into the pool. Plumes of mud stirred near the bank, obscuring the fine web of tendrils that laced through the pond from overhanging vines. This was the last of a chain of small basins, a few kilometers from the caves. As Athaclena worked, she concentrated and kept careful notes, for she knew she was no trained scientist and would have to make up for that with meticulousness. Still, her simple experiments had already begun to bear promising results. If her assistants returned from the next valley in time with the data she had sent for, she might have something of importance to show Major Prathachulthorn.
"I may look like a freak, but I am still Timbrimi. I shall prove my usefulness, even if the Earthmen do not think of me as a warrior."
So intense was her concentration, so quiet the still forest, that sudden words were like thunderclaps. So this is where you are, Clenny. I've been looking all over for you. Hathaclenna spun about, almost spilling a vial of umber-colored fluid. The vines all around her suddenly felt like a net woven just to catch her. Her pulse pounded for the fraction of a second it took to recognize Robert. Looking down at her from the arching root of a giant near oak. He wore moccasins, a soft leather jerkin, and hose. The bow and quiver across his back made him look like the hero of one of those old-time wolfling romances Athaclena's mother used to read to her when she was a child. It took longer to regain her composure than she would have preferred.
"Robert, you startled me."
He blushed. "Sorry, didn't mean to." That wasn't strictly true, she knew. Robert's sigh shield was better than before, and he obviously was proud of being able to approach undetected. A simple but clear vision of Kinney Woolen flickered like a pixie over Robert's head. If she squinted, she might almost imagine a young Timbrimmy male standing there. Athaclenna shuddered. She had already decided she could not afford this.
"Come and sit down, Robert. Tell me what you have been doing."
Holding onto a nearby vine, he swung lightly onto the leaf-strewn loam and stepped over to where her experiment case lay open beside the dark pool. Robert slipped off his bow and quiver and sat down, cross-legged. "I've been looking around for some way to be useful," he shrugged. "Pratha Chilthorn's finished pumping me for information. Now he wants me to serve as sort of a glorified Chim morale officer." His voice rose a quarter octave as he mimicked the Terrigan Marine's South Asian accent. "We must keep the little fellows' chins up, Bon Eagle. Make them feel they're important to the resistance." Athaclenna nodded, understanding Robert's unspoken meaning. In spite of the partisan's past successes, Pratha Chilthorn obviously considered the Chims superfluous, at best useful in diversions or as grunt soldiery. Liaison to childlike clients would seem an appropriate cubbyhole to assign the undertrained, presumably spoiled, young son of the planetary coordinator.
"I thought Pratha Chilthorn liked your idea of using digestion bacteria against the Gubru,"
Athaclenna said. Robert sniffed. He picked up a twig and twirled it deftly from finger to finger. "Oh, he admitted it was intriguing that the gorilla's gut critters dissolved Gubru armor. He agreed to assign Benjamin and some of the Chim techs to my project." Athaclenna tried to trace the murky pattern of his feelings.
"Did not Lieutenant McHugh help you persuade him?"
Robert looked away at the mention of the young Earthling woman. His shield went up at the same time, confirming some of Athaclenna's suspicions. "Lydia helped, yeah, but Pratha Chilthorn says it'd be next to impossible to deliver enough bacteria to important Gubru installations before they detect it and neutralize it. I still get the impression Pratha Chilthorn thinks it a side issue, maybe slightly useful to his main plan."
"Do you have any idea what he has in mind?"
"He smiles and says he's going to bloody the bird's beaks. There's been intelligence of some major facility the Gubru are building, south of Port Helena, and that may make a good target. But he won't go into any more detail than that. After all, strategy and tactics are for professionals, don't you know? Anyway, I didn't come here to talk about Pratha Chilthorn. I brought something to show you." Robert shrugged out of his pack and reached inside to pull out an object wrapped in cloth. He unfolded the coverings. "Look familiar at all?" At first sight, it appeared to be a pile of wrinkled rags with knotted strings hanging off the edges. On closer examination, the thing on Robert's lap reminded Athaclenna of a shriveled fungus of some sort. Robert grabbed the largest knot, where most of the thin fibers came together in a clump, and extended the strings until the filmy fabric unfolded entirely in the gentle breeze.
It looks familiar, Robert. I would say it was a small parachute, but it is obviously natural. as if it came from some sort of plant.
She shook her head. Pretty close. Try to think back a few months, Clenny, to a certain rather traumatic day. One I don't think either of us will ever forget. His words were opaque, but flickerings of empathy drew her memories forth.
This?
Ethelklena fingered the soft, almost translucent material.
This is from the plate ivy?
That's right, Robert nodded. In springtime, the upper layers are glossy, rubbery, and so stiff you can flip them and ride them as sleds.
If you are coordinated,
Ethelklena teased. Yeah. But by the time autumn rolls around, the upper plates have withered back until they're like this. He waved the floppy parachute-like plate by its fibrous shrouds, catching the wind. In a few more weeks, they'll be even lighter. Ethelklena shook her head.
I recall you explained the reason. It is for propagation, is it not?
Correct. This little spore pod here. He opened his hand to show a small capsule where the lines met. It gets carried aloft by the parachute into the late autumn winds. The sky fills with the things, making air travel hazardous for some time. They cause a real mess down in the city. Fortunately, I guess, the ancient creatures that used to pollinate the plate ivy went extinct during the Burr Alley fiasco. And nearly all of the pods are sterile. If they weren't, I guess half the Sind would be covered with plate ivy by now. Whatever used to eat it is long dead as well.
Fascinating.
Ethelklena followed a tremor in Robert's aura.
You have plans for these things, do you not?
He folded the spore carrier away again.
Yeah, an idea at least, though I don't imagine Pratha Chilthorn will listen to me. He's got me too well categorized, thanks to my mother.
Of course, Megan Oneagle was partly responsible for the Earthling officer's assessment and dismissal of her son.
How can a mother so misunderstand her own child?
Ethelklena wondered. Humans might have come a long way since their dark centuries, but she still pitied the K'chunon, the poor wolflings. They still had much to learn about themselves.
Pratha Chilthorn might not listen to you directly, Robert, but Lieutenant McHugh has his respect. She will certainly hear you out and convey your idea to the Major.
Robert shook his head. I don't know.
Why not?
Ethelklena asked.
This young Earth woman likes you, I can tell. In fact, I was quite certain I detected in her aura.
You shouldn't do that, Clenny. Robert snapped. You shouldn't nose around at people's feelings that way. It's none of your business. She looked down.
Perhaps you were right, but you are my friend and consort, Robert. When you are tense and frustrated, it is bad for both of us, no?
I guess so. He did not meet her gaze.
Are you sexually attracted to this Lydia McHugh, then?
Ethelklena asked.
Do you feel affection for her?
I don't see why you have to ask.
Because I cannot ken you, Robert,
Ethelklena interrupted, partly out of irritation.
You are no longer open to me. If you are having such feelings, you should share them with me. Perhaps I can help you.
Now he looked at her, his face flushed.
Help me? Of course. You are my consort and friend. If you desire this woman of your own species, should I not be your collaborator? Should I not help you achieve happiness?
Robert only blinked. But in his tight shield, Ethelklena now found cracks. She felt her tendrils wafting over her ears, tracing the edges of those loose places, forming a delicate new glyph.
Were you feeling guilty over these feelings, Robert? Did you think they were somehow being disloyal to me?
Ethelklena laughed.
But interspecies consorts may have lovers and spouses of their own race. You knew that. So, what would you have of me, Robert? I certainly cannot give you children. If I could, can you imagine what mongrels they would be?
This time Robert smiled. He looked away. In the space between them, her glyph took stronger form.
And as for recreational sex, you know that I am not equipped to leave you anything but frustrated, you over-endowed, under-endowed, wrong-shaped ape-man. Why should I not take joy in it, if you find one with whom you might share such things?
It's not as easy as that, Clenny. She held up a hand and smiled, at once beseeching him to be quiet and to let go.
I am here, Robert,
she said softly. The young man's confusion was like an uncertain quantum potential, hesitating between two states. His eyes darted as he glanced upward and tried to focus on the non-thing she had made. Then he remembered what he had learned and looked away again, allowing Kenning to open him to the glyph, her gift.
Lathsoon
hovered and danced, beckoning to him. Robert exhaled. His eyes opened in surprise as his own aura unlocked without his conscious will. Uncurling like a flower, something, a twin to
Lathsoon,
emerged, resonating, amplifying against Athoclena's corona. Two wisps of nothing, one human, one Timbremi, touched, darted apart playfully, and came together again.
Do not fear that you will lose what you have with me, Robert,
Athoclena whispered.
After all, will any human lover be able to do this with you?
At that, he smiled. They shared laughter. Overhead, mirrored,
Lathsoon
manifested intimacy performed in pairs. Only later, after Robert had departed again, did Athoclena loosen the deep shield she had locked around her own innermost feelings. Only when he was gone did she let herself acknowledge her envy.
He goes to her now.
What Athoclena had done was right, by any standard she knew. She had done the proper thing, and yet it was so unfair.
I am a freak. I was one before I ever came to this planet. Now I am not even anything recognizable any longer.
Robert might have an earthly lover, but in that area Athoclena was all alone. She could seek no such solace with one of her own kind.
To touch me, to hold me, to mingle his tendrils and his body with mine, to make me feel a flame.
With some surprise, Athoclena noticed that this was the first time she had ever felt this thing, this longing to be with a man of her own race, not a friend or a classmate, but a lover, perhaps a mate. Mathakluwana and Utha Kalving had told her it would happen some day, that every girl has her own pace. Now, however, the feeling was only bitter. It enhanced her loneliness. A part of her blamed Robert for the limitations of his species. If only he could have changed his body as well. If only he could have met her halfway. But she was the Timbremi, one of the masters of adaptability. How far that malleability had gone was made evident when Athoclena felt wetness on her cheeks. Miserably, she wiped away salty tears, the first in her life. That was how her assistants found her hours later, when they returned from the errand she had sent them on, sitting by the edge of a small muddy pool, while autumn winds blew through the treetops and sent gravid clouds hurrying eastward toward the gray mountains. Chapter 62 Galactics. The suzerain of Cost and Caution was worried. All signs pointed to a molting, and the direction things appeared to be going was not to its liking. Across the pavilion, the suzerain of beam and talon paced in front of its aides, looking more erect and stately than ever. Beneath the shaggy outer feathers, there was a faint reddish sheen to the military commander's underplumage. Not a single Gubru present could help but notice even a trace of that color. Soon, perhaps within only a 12-day, the process would have progressed beyond the point of no return. The occupation force would have a new queen. The suzerain of Cost and Caution contemplated the unfairness of it all as it preened its own feathers. They, too, were starting to dry out, but there were still no discernible signs of a final color. First, it had been elevated to the status of candidate and chief bureaucrat after the death of its predecessor. It had dreamed of such a destiny, but not to be plunged into the midst of an already mature triumvirate. Its peers were already well on the way toward sexuality by that time. It had been forced to try to catch up. At first, that had seemed to matter little. To the surprises of all, it had won many points from the start. Discovering the foolishness the other two had been up to during the interregnum had enabled the suzerain of Cost and Caution to make great leaps forward. Then a new equilibrium was reached. The admiral and the priest had proven brilliant and imaginative in the defense of their political positions. But the molting was supposed to be decided by correctness of policy. The prize was supposed to go to the leader whose wisdom had proven most sage. It was the way. And yet the bureaucrat knew that these matters were as often decided by happenstance or by quirks of metabolism.
"Or by alliance of two against the third," it reminded itself.
The suzerain of Cost and Caution wondered if it had been wise to support the military against propriety these last few weeks, giving the admiral by now an almost unassailable advantage. But there had been no choice. The priest had to be opposed, for the suzerain of propriety appeared to have lost all control. First had come that nonsense about Garthlings. If the bureaucrat's predecessor had lived, perhaps the extravagance might have been kept down. As it was, however, vast amounts had been squandered, bringing in a new planetary branch library, sending expeditions into the dangerous mountains, building a hyperspace shunt for a ceremony of adoption, before there was any confirmation that anything existed to adopt. Then there was the matter of ecological management. The suzerain of propriety insisted that it was essential to restore the Earthlings' program on Garth to at least a minimal level. But the suzerain of Beam and Talon had adamantly refused to allow any humans to leave the islands. So, at great cost, help was sent for off-planet. A shipload of Linton Gardeners, neutrals in the present crisis, were on the way. And the great egg only knew how they were to pay for them. Now that the hyperspace shunt was nearing completion, both the suzerain of propriety and the suzerain of Beam and Talon were ready to admit that the rumors of Garthlings were just a Timbrimmy trick. But would they allow construction to be stopped? No. Each, it seemed, had its reasons for wanting completion. If the bureaucrat had agreed, it would have made a consensus, a step toward the policy so much desired by the roostmasters. But how could it agree with such nonsense? The suzerain of Cost and Caution chirped in frustration. The suzerain of propriety was late for yet another colloquy. Its passion for rectitude did not extend, it seemed, to courtesy to its peers. By this point, theoretically, the initial competitiveness among the candidates should have been transforming into respect, and then affection, and finally true mating. But here they were, on the verge of a molt, still dancing a dance of mutual loathing. The suzerain of Cost and Caution was not happy about how things were turning out, but at least there would be one satisfaction if things went on in the direction they seemed headed. When propriety was brought down from its haughty perch at last. One of the chief bureaucrat's aides approached, and the suzerain took its proffered message slab. After picking its contents, It stood and thought. Outside there was a commotion, no doubt the third peer arriving at last. But for a moment the suzerain of Cost and Caution still considered the message it had received from its spies.
"Soon, yes, soon. Very soon we will penetrate secret plans, plans which may not be good policy. Then perhaps we shall see a change in sexuality. Soon."
Chapter 63 Fibbon. His head ached. Back when he had been a student at the university, he had also been forced to study hour after hour, days at a stretch, cramming for tests. Fibbon had never thought of himself as a scholar, and sometimes examinations used to make him sick in anticipation. But at least back then there were also extracurricular activities, trips home, breathing spells, when a chin could cut loose and have some fun. And back at the university, Fibbon had liked some of his professors. Right at this moment, though, he had had just about as much as he could take of Galet Jones.
"So you think galactic sociology's stuffy and tedious?"
Galet accused him after he threw down the books in disgust and stalked off to pace in the farthest corner of the room.
"Well, I'm sorry planetary ecology isn't the subject instead," she said. "Then maybe you'd be the teacher and I'd be the student."
Fibbon snorted.
"Thanks for allowing for the possibility. I was beginning to think you already knew everything."
"That's not fair."
Galet put aside the heavy book on her lap.
"You know the ceremony's only weeks away. At that point, you and I may be called upon to act as spokesmen for our entire race. Shouldn't we try to be as prepared as possible beforehand?"
"And you're so certain you know what knowledge will be relevant? What's to say that planetary ecology won't be crucial then, hmm?"
Galet shrugged.
"It might very well be."
"Or mechanics, or space piloting, or beer swilling, or sexual aptitude, for good all's sake."
"In that case, our race will be fortunate. You were selected as one of its representatives, won't it?"
Galet snapped back. There was a long, tense silence as they glared at each other. Finally, Galet lifted a hand.
"Fibbon, I'm sorry. I know this is frustrating for you, but I didn't ask to be put in this position either, you know."
"No, but that doesn't matter," he thought. "You were designed for it. Neo-chimpdom couldn't hope for a chimmy better suited to be rational, collected, and oh, so cool when the time comes."
"As for galactic sociology, Fibbon, you know there are several reasons why it's the essential topic."
There it was again, that look in Galet's eyes. Fibbon knew it meant that there were levels and levels in her words. Superficially, she meant that the two Chim representatives would have to know the right protocols and pass certain stringent tests during the rituals of acceptance, or the officials of the Institute of Uplift would declare the ceremonies null and void. The suzerain of propriety had made it abundantly clear that the outcome would be most unpleasant if that happened. But there was another reason Galet wanted him to know as much as possible.
"Sometime soon we pass the point of no return, when we can no longer change our minds about cooperating with the suzerain. Galet and I cannot discuss it openly, not with the Gubru probably listening in all the time. We'll have to act in consensus, and to her that means I've got to be educated."
Or was it simply that Galet did not want to bear the burden of their decision all by herself when the time came? Certainly Fibbon knew a lot more about galactic civilization than before his capture, perhaps more than he had ever wanted to know. The intricacies of a 3-billion-year-old culture made up of 1,000 diverse, bickering, patron-client clan lines, held together loosely by a network of ancient institutes and traditions, made Fibbon's head swim. Half the time he would come away cynically disgusted, convinced that the Galactics were little more than powerful, spoiled brats combining the worst qualities of the old nation-states of Earth before mankind's maturity. But then something would crystallize, and Galet would make clear to him some tradition or principle that displayed uncanny subtlety and hard-won wisdom developed over hundreds of millions of years. It was getting to the point where he didn't even know what to think anymore.
"I gotta get some air," he told her. "I'm going for a walk."
He stepped over to the coat rack and grabbed his parka.
"See you in an hour or so."
He rapped on the door. It slid open. He stepped through and closed it behind him without looking back.
"Need an escort, Fibbon?"
The chimney Sylvie picked up a data well and scribbled an entry. She wore a simple ankle-length dress with long sleeves. To look at her now, it was hard to imagine her up on the dance mound at the Ape's Grape, driving crowds of Chens to the verge of mob violence. Her smile was hesitant, almost timid, and it occurred to Fibbon that there was something unaccountably nervous about her tonight.
"What if I said no?" he asked.
Before Sylvie could look alarmed, he grinned.
"Just kidding. Sure, Sylvie, give me Rover 12. He's a friendly old globe, and he doesn't spook the natives too much."
"Watch robot RVG-12, logged as escort to Fibbon Bulger for release outside,"
she said into the data well. A door opened down the hallway behind her, and out floated a remote vigilance globe. A simple version of a battle robot, whose sole mission was to accompany a prisoner and see that he did not escape.
"Have a nice walk, Fibbon."
He winked at Sylvie and affected an airy burr.
"Now, lass, what other kind is there for a prisoner?"
"The last one," Fibbon answered himself. "The one leading to the gallows." But he waved gaily.
"Come on, Rover."
The front door hissed as it slid back to let him emerge into a blustery autumn afternoon. Much had changed since their capture. The conditions of their imprisonment grew gentler as he and Galet seemed to become more important to the suzerain of propriety's inscrutable plan.
"I still hate this place,"
Fibbon thought as he descended concrete steps and made his way through an unkempt garden toward the outer gate. Sophisticated surveillance robots rotated slowly at the corners of the high wall. Near the portal, Fibbon came upon the Chim guards. Iron Grip was not present, fortunately, but the other probationers on duty were hardly friendlier. For although the Gubru still paid their wages, it seemed their masters had recently deserted their cause. There had been no overturning of the uplift program on Garth, no sudden reversal of the eugenics pyramid.
"The suzerain tried to find fault in the way neo-chimps are being uplifted,"
Fibbon knew.
"But it must have failed. Otherwise, why would it be grooming a blue card and a white card like me and Galet for their ceremony?"
In fact, the use of probationers as auxiliaries had sort of backfired on the invaders. The Chim population resented it. No words passed between Fibbon and the zip-suited guards. The ritual was well understood. He ignored them, and they dawdled just as long as they dared, without giving him an excuse to complain. Once, when the clavager delayed too long with the keys, Fibbon had simply turned around and marched back inside. He did not even have to say a word to Sylvie. Next watch, those guards were gone. Fibbon never saw them again. This time, just on impulse, Fibbon broke tradition and spoke.
"Nice weather, ain't it?"
The taller of the two probationers looked up in surprise. Something about the zip-suited Chen suddenly struck Fibbon as eerily familiar, although he was certain he had never met him before. What, are you kidding? The guard glanced up at the rumbling, cumulo-nimbus clouds. A cold front was moving in, and rain could not be far off.
Yeah, Piven grinned. I'm kidding. Actually, it's too sunny for my tastes.
The guard gave Fibbin a sour look and stepped aside. The gate squeaked open, and Fibbin slipped out onto a back street, lined by ivy-decked walls. Neither he nor Gala had ever seen any of their neighbors. Presumably, local chims kept a low profile around Iron Grip's crew and the watchful alien robots. He whistled as he walked toward the bay, trying to ignore the hovering watch globe, following just a meter above and behind him. The first time he had been allowed out this way, Fibbin avoided the populated areas of Port Helena, sticking to back alleys and the now almost abandoned industrial zone. Nowadays he still kept away from the main shopping and business areas, where crowds would gather and stare. But he no longer felt he had to avoid people completely. Early on, he had seen other chims accompanied by watch globes. At first, he thought they were prisoners like himself. Chens and chimmies in work clothes stepped aside and gave the guarded chims wide berth, as they did him. Then he noticed the differences. Those other escorted chims wore fine clothes and walked with a haughty bearing. Their watch globes, eye facets, and weaponry faced outward, rather than upon the ones they guarded. Quislings, Fibbin realized. He was pleased to see the faces of many Chim citizens cast at these high-level collaborators when their backs were turned. Looks of sullen, ill-concealed disdain. After that, in his quarters, he had stenciled the proud letters PRISONER on the back of his parka. From then on, the stares that followed him were less cold. They were curious, perhaps even respectful. The globe was not programmed to let him speak to people. Once, when a chimmy dropped a folded piece of paper in his path, Fibbin tested the machine's tolerance by bending over to pick it up. He awoke some time later in the globe's grasp, on his way back to prison. It was several days before he was allowed out again. No matter, it had been worth it. Word of the episode spread. Now chens and chimmies nodded as he passed storefronts and long ration lines. Some even signed little messages of encouragement in hand talk.
They haven't twisted us, Fibbin thought proudly.
A few traitors hardly mattered. What counted was the behavior of a people as a whole. Fibbin remembered reading how, during the most horrible of Earth's old pre-contact world wars, the citizens of the little nation of Denmark resisted every effort of the Nazi conquerors to dehumanize them. Instead, they behaved with startling unity and decency. It was a story well worth emulating.
"We'll hold out," he replied in sign language. "Terra remembers, and will come for us."
He clung to the hope, no matter how hard it became. As he learned the subtleties of galactic law from Galet, he came to realize that even if peace broke out all across the spiral arms, it might not be enough to eject the invaders. There were tricks a clan as ancient as the Gubru knew— ways to invalidate a weaker clan's lease on a planet like Garth. It was apparent one faction of the avian enemy wanted to end Earth's tenancy here and take it over for themselves. Fibbin knew that the suzerain of propriety had searched in vain for evidence the Earthlings were mishandling the ecological recovery on Garth. Now, after the way the occupation forces had bollocked decades of hard work, they dared not raise that issue. The suzerain had also spent months hunting for elusive Garthlings. If the mysterious pre-sentience had proven real, a claim on them would have justified every dime spent here. Finally, they saw through Utha Calding's practical joke, but that did not end their efforts. All along, ever since the invasion, the Gubru had tried to find fault with the way neo-chimpanzees were being uplifted. And just because they seemed to have accepted the status of advanced chimps like Galit, that did not mean they had given up completely. There was this business of the damned ceremony of acceptance, whose implications still escaped Fibbon, no matter how hard Galit tried to make them clear to him. He hardly noticed the chimps on the street as his feet kicked wind-blown leaves and snatches of Galit's explanations came back to him.
Client species pass through phases each marked by ceremonies, sanctioned by the Galactic Uplift Institute. These ceremonies are expensive and can be blocked by political maneuvering. For the Gubru to offer to pay for and support a ceremony for the clients of wolfling humans is more than unprecedented, and the suzerain also offers to commit all its folk to a new policy ending hostilities with Earth. Of course, there is a catch.
Oh, Fibbon could well imagine there would be a catch. He shook his head, as if to drive all the words out of it. There was something unnatural about Galit. Uplift was all very well and good, and she might be a peerless example of neo-chimpdom. But it just wasn't natural to think and talk so much without giving the brain some off time to air out. He came at last to a place by the docks where fishing boats lay tied up against the coming storm. Seabirds chirped and dove, trying to catch a last meal in the time remaining before the water became too choppy. One of them ventured too close to Fibbon and was rewarded with a warning shock from Rover, the watch robot. The bird, no more a biological cousin to the avian invaders than Fibbon was, squawked in anger and took off toward the west. Fibbon took a seat on the end of the pier. From his pocket he removed half a sandwich he had put there earlier in the day. He munched quietly, watching the clouds and the water. For the moment at least, he was able to stop thinking, stop worrying, and no words echoed in his head. Right then, all it would have taken to make him happy would have been a banana and a beer. And freedom. An hour or so later, Rover began buzzing insistently. The watch robot maneuvered to a position, interposing itself between him and the water, bobbing insistently. Fibbon got up and dusted himself off. He walked back along the dock, and soon was headed past drifts of leaves toward his urban prison. Very few chimps were still about on the windy streets. The guard with the oddly familiar face frowned at him when Fibbon arrived at the gate, but there was no delay passing him through. "It's always been easier getting into jail than getting out," Fibbon thought. Sylvie was still on duty at her desk.
"Did you have a nice walk, Fibbon?"
"You ought to come along sometime. We could stop at the park, and I'd show you my cheetah imitation."
He gave her an amiable wink.
"I've already seen it, remember? Pretty unimpressive, as I recall."
But Sylvie's tone did not match her banter. She seemed tense.
"Go on in, Fibbon. I'll put Rover away."
"Yeah, well..."
The door hissed open.
"All right, Sylvie."
Galit was seated on a plush throw rug in front of the weather wall, now tuned to show a scene of steamy savanna heat. She looked up from the book on her lap and took off her reading glasses.
"Hello, feeling better?"
"Yeah," he nodded.
"Sorry about earlier. I guess I just had a bad case of cabin fever. I'll knuckle down and get back to work now."
"No need, we're done for today."
She patted the rug.
"Why don't you come over and give me back a scratch? Then I'll reciprocate."
Fibbon did not have to be asked twice. One thing he had to grant Galit, she was a truly fine grooming partner. He shrugged out of his parka and came over to sit behind her. She laid one hand idly on his knee while he began combing his fingers through her hair. Soon her eyes were closed. Her breath came in soft, low sighs.